part two, listeners' questions. First of all, thank you very much for Philip and David coming in today and giving such a great description of both of your points of view. We have a bunch of questions from people on Twitter, but before we get onto that, I just wanted to raise one question about something that was raised in the discussion, which was, why do we think that dualism seems to be the most intuitive response to this issue? Why is it that it appears to be the average way of thinking?
Okay, so as I said a few times earlier, there seems to be a strong intuition in favor of dualism, despite all the arguments, which, I mean, Philip agrees about this, are against dualism. You end up with epiphenomenalism. There's strong arguments for avoiding dualism, but people, including us, I think, can't help but think in dualist terms often. So there's a kind of psychological, sociological question. What's the explanation for this resistance to monism in our kind of unreflective thinking? There's quite a lot of literature on this, and I'll just mention a few of the suggestions that have been put forward very quickly. So one thought is that it's part of our historical culture. Many of us live in societies that have religious history, and religion certainly separates the mind and the brain, and maybe that lives on in most people's thinking. Another answer is the Yale psychologist wrote a book called Descartes' Baby. He thinks we're all natural-born dualists. He thinks the way the brain divides the world very early on, I mean, with very young children, into the minded, the sentient parts of the world, the inanimate parts of the world, very deep in our thinking, and we can't really countenance something being in both categories, like the mind-brain. How many? That's two ones. I've got an idea. I've dubbed it the antipathetic fallacy, which is that the way we think about pains are C-fibers, and on the first, when we think pains, we imagine the pain. When we think C-fibers, we don't imagine the pain. Then we think the C-fibers leave out the pain, and that's a kind of confusion that's quite seductive, I think. Here's another thought. Here's a fourth suggestion. Philip thinks that when we introspect, the nature of our experiences is completely revealed to us. I don't think that's a good thought, but it may be a quite intuitively natural, compelling thought, and to the extent people think that, they'll think that what's revealed to them is it's not physical. So that's another thing that might push people towards dualism. Final suggestion is that there's something about our cognitive architecture. Normally when we discover identity, Superman is Clark Kent. We kind of had two files in our mental filing system, one with the Clark Kent information, one with the Superman information. We discovered they're the same thing. We merged the files, and some people argue that the way we think about brain states is in one part of the brain. The way we think intuitively of experiences in terms of what they're like is in another part of the brain, and we just kind of can't merge the files given the way these two ways of thinking are housed in separate parts of the brain. And there's some literature arguing between these different explanations. And I used to engage in this, and I now think, why are we fighting? These aren't competing explanations. These are different suggestions at pressures that push us towards dualism. Maybe let 1,000 schools of thought agree, and 5 schools of thought agree. Maybe these are all pressures that push people towards dualism, and that's why dualism is so prevalent.
First question from Twitter comes from Consciousness Plus, or Adrian Nelson, the author of Origin of Consciousness. He poses the question, what are the ethical implications of panpsychism?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and not something I've thought a great deal about. I mean, to my mind, actually, I think it has had a kind of ethical impact on my life, but only in one regard, and might be thought of as quite a surprising one. I think it stops me being vegetarian. I think if I wasn't a panpsychist, I'd probably be a vegetarian. I saw recently a documentary, a really good mock documentary. Have you seen this? What's it called? By the comedian Simon Amstel.
Yeah.
what's it called? About this mock. Have you seen this, David? No, it's sort of set in the future where everyone's given up. Everyone's become vegan. They've all realized what a horrible thing it is to abuse animals, and they're looking back into the past about how that happened, and this kind of self-help groups about people who can't bear the guilt that they used to eat cheese and stuff. And anyway, it's very, very good. But at one point he says, at this time, humans realized that it was wrong to eat something with an inner life. And but the problem for me is I am very, very confident that plants have an inner life, are conscious. And so you've got to eat something. It's hard to know where to draw the line. So quite seriously, I think if I just thought animals were conscious and plants weren't, then I'd probably, that seems like a good dividing line, I'd probably be vegetarian or vegan. But because there isn't that dividing line, it's hard to know. So, I mean, I worry about animal suffering and take that into consideration, but I suppose I can't draw a line between what I think it's ethically permissible to kill and not. But yeah, maybe that's a slightly disappointing answer. I think I know my fellow panpsychist, Hedda Hassel-Mürk, thinks that there's some really important positive ethical implications of panpsychism. It will help us sort of relate to the world in better terms, but I don't quite see that myself. I mean, if physicalism were to work, then we'd be sort of continuous with nature and all being physical. I don't think physicalism does work. Panpsychism has the same implication that we're all sort of continuous with nature. And that's the only one that I've got to as yet. But I'm really, it's an interesting question, and I'd like to hear more about it and think more about it.
Can I just quickly add one thing before David speaks, which is, would not most people just say you'd have to prioritize the consciousness that can experience pain? And that, because I think the biggest issue would be on an environmental basis, you might say, right, the trees and everything need protection. But even that would be contingent on the fact that if they're not protected, then other types of consciousness that can experience pain would be worse off.
Yeah, well, who's to say trees can't feel pain? I'm not entirely. I was turned to this about to my another panpsychist of a form, Miri Al-Bahari, who spends very interesting kind of in the Hindu Buddhist tradition. She's a scholar, works on got a book called Analytic Buddhism, and she was saying, sharing my view that plants are conscious, and said, watch The Secret Life of Plants. I think I haven't watched this yet. But, sort of sped up plants, and she thinks, once you see plants sped up, that gives you a little doubt that they're conscious. Yeah, so it's not obvious to me that trees don't feel pain, actually. And
but I think you probably would agree that we need to think about which beings are suffering and maybe minimize suffering, and maybe even plants get in on the suffering. I mean, presumably you're going to think that, I don't know, viruses don't suffer, or anyway, electrons don't suffer. And I think that let's put killing to one side. Let's just think about animal welfare and suffering. And I think that's an important issue, obviously. And I think panpsychism is helpful in this way. And you posed it. Don't we want to find out whether the animals, let's stick to animals, are consciously in pain? And I worry that the emphasis on consciously there is not being helpful. Many people think about this. Look, here we've got flies and bees, and our animal protection laws are quite strict about, especially in respect to research, what you can do to mammals. And octopuses have been allowed in, but they allow the researchers free rein when it comes to arthropods, other mollusks apart from the cephalopods, and so on. And right, many people think that the issue here is, are they conscious? And they spend a lot of time trying to find out a way of answering that question. And I feel, from my somewhat panpsychist point of view, that's a red herring. I mean, you should think about what's going on in these animals. Let's study bees and see how they react to various circumstances, what how flexible their behavior is, what they seem to find valuable, what they're attracted to, what dissuades them from things, how they react in various situations. And just on that basis, don't ask, are they conscious? Do they get across the line dividing the non-conscious? Just ask, are they suffering? Is this behavior making, I mean, is this treatment making them suffer? Mm. And decide how to behave on that basis. I think that the agonizing about whether they're conscious or not is a red herring that can sometimes allow people, look at Descartes, to feel that they can justify things which clearly are unjustifiable.
Right, essentially. So maybe there are sort of positive and sort of negative implications for animal welfare, or maybe that's not the right way. Yeah. But so in one hand, it might make us feel more sympathetic to bees. Mm. But on the other hand, it doesn't give an obvious dividing line between the things you can eat and the things you can't. But so there's two sort of...
Now, well, what you can eat. So, I mean, I'm with you. I'm not against eating rather complicated, sophisticated beings, provided that they don't suffer during their lives. And... Yeah. Are killed yeah. painlessly, and perhaps we should think about their relationships to their offspring, their parents, and so on. I mean, there's quite a lot to take into account. But I don't rule out killing animals for food, but I do rule out their suffering unnecessarily. Mm. So,
okay, the next question is from two particular users, one from a not-so-unique username, spelt with a 3 at the end, also from Consciousness Plus once more. And the question is as follows. What do you think is the most plausible answer to the combination problem?
Yeah, I was waiting for this one to come. So, this is seen to be, I guess, the big problem for panpsychism, and it is a very serious problem. So the worry is, okay, so we attribute basic consciousness to the basic parts of the brain, but then we've still got a question, how do we get from how do those little things with their basic consciousness make up my consciousness, the consciousness of my brain? And you know we have a good understanding how parts of a car engine make up a car engine, or parts of a computer make up a computer, but it's really hard to make sense of the idea of lots of little minds making up big mind. So this is just there's a lot of arguments to pad that out into, but that's the basic intuition. And if we can't solve that, people think, well, we've got a big problem for panpsychism, because it's human consciousness we want to explain after all, or human and animal consciousness. Most panpsychists will think of it as a sort of work in progress, and think that, admit that currently there's no wholly adequate account of this. And then some people think, okay, well, that's a good reason to just forget it, reject panpsychism. My reaction to that is, it's a bit like saying to early Darwinians, well, you haven't given a complete account of how the eye evolves, so, this natural selection stuff must be a load of rubbish. This is early days in science of consciousness, and I think there's a very attractive theory here that avoids both the worries about dualism and, in my view, the worries about physicalism. And, there are still some problems. Actually, some people say, well, what's the difference with physicalism then? Physicalism can't solve the hard problem yet, at least. Panpsychism can't solve the combination problem. Again, it depends on, and again, this comes back to the need to have a sort of deeper understanding of the hard problem of consciousness itself. The arguments that motivate it, such as the knowledge argument, purport to show that physicalism can't possibly account for consciousness, indeed that it's incompatible with the existence of consciousness. So if those arguments are sound, they might not be, David and I have been debating that, then, that gives us an incredibly strong reason to think physicalism is false, because it's inconsistent with the existence of consciousness. We know consciousness exists, therefore physicalism must be false. Panpsychism doesn't have that. Nobody thinks panpsychism is inconsistent with the existence of consciousness. So even though it does have problems, such as the combination problem, I still think it's in much better position than physicalism.
Philip, can I ask you a somewhat technical question? Might interest the listeners about your own position. It's not clear to me exactly why the combination problem is a combination problem for you. Here's how I understand the combination problem. Some people put it like this. Look, take all the neurons, and they've all got their kind of proto-consciousness, and put them together, and then we get pains. But conceivability argument, I could conceive all those neurons with their proto-consciousness, but a kind of zombie that doesn't have pains, and since what's conceivable is possible, now we're in a mess. But your relationship to the conceivability argument is rather complicated. You kind of take something out of it, and what does the work from your own argumentative point of view is the idea of phenomenal thinking being transparent, being revelatory. It's not clear to me why, from your position, you regard the combination problem as a problem.
Why not? I don't.
Well, so phrase it. I mean, here's all the neurons with their proto, and then put them together, you get this extra kind of consciousness. Why is that a puzzle for you? What's supposed?
The way you put it there is actually the way I originally framed it in a paper in 2009 as a kind of conceivability thing. So we can think of panpsychist zombies.
Right.
So all their little, you know, they're like normal philosophical zombies, the physical duplicates of human beings. But all their, unlike normal zombies, all their little bits are conscious, but there's no consciousness associated with the organism as a whole.
Right.
So you think, you know, if you think conceivability is a guide to possibility, then they're possible. And then that seems to give you reason to think that panpsychism can't account for human consciousness, which is what... And so that's a particularly worrying argument, because you think, like, panpsychism is motivated by things like the zombie argument. If the same argument applies back to the panpsychist, then it looks pretty hopeless.
But
that would be the...
But of course, you don't, as does nobody, think that in general conceivability is a guide to possibility. It's only conceivability when thought using various concepts.
But it looks like the concepts involved here are consciousness concepts. Like
good. So you've got, on the one hand, the concepts of all the neurons with their proto-phenomenality, and then you have on the other the pain that arrives when you put them together. And we're thinking of both of those in terms of a revelatory phenomenal concept, but it's supposed to reveal what? That when you put these together, you'll get the big pain? The other way around, when you conceive of the big pain, you ought to see its parts. That's the grain problem we were talking about earlier. You have the problem both ways round.
So I think conceivability entails possibility when you grasp the natures of everything involved in your conception. I mean, if these panpsychist zombies were just done by consciousness concepts, when we attribute consciousness to their parts, and maybe sort of physical concepts to describe dispositional causal roles, they seem kind of transparent as well. So it seems like we understand everything that's going on. I mean, one possibility is, well, now, there are other components that are essential to combination. So in my paper in the Oxford University Press Panpsychism volume that came out last year, I suggest what I call the phenomenal bonding solution, that maybe it seems like what's important to combination in general is the relationships. So maybe it's the physical relationships between the micro-level entities that matter. It's not obvious if you're a Russellian monist. It's not just kind of intrinsic properties that we, physical properties like mass and charge, that we don't have a grip on the intrinsic nature of, but relationships, spatial relationships, causal relationships. So that would block the conceivability argument. So there's some essential component of combination, which I dub phenomenal bonding, which is a physical relationship, but we don't know its intrinsic. If we knew its intrinsic nature, then the whole thing would be transparent to us. So that's one solution I entertain. I mean, in a way, it's not wholly satisfying, because we there's something we don't get. We don't get the nature of phenomenal bonding. Maybe we never will. But I'm actually quite happy with the idea that the nature might not reveal all its secrets. And you might think, oh, that's very defeatist. But I think we've been lulled into a kind of false confidence because of the success of physical science. You know, think, oh my God, we're getting everything. But from the Russellian monist perspective, the reason physical science has been so successful is it's just focused on causal structure. So we know a lot about causal structure, but if you think, you know, we're naturally evolved creatures, well, I think we're going to be able to get at the intrinsic nature of all of matter.
I can get behind that, Philip. You're starting to sound like me.
Oh, no, Warby. Oh, maybe I'll back up. So I mean, I also think, maybe we don't need to go into this, I also think cosmopsychism. So I talked about priority monism before. If you can join priority monism with panpsychism, you get the view called cosmopsychism. The everything is grounded in facts about the conscious universe. I think that helps with some aspects of the combination problem. It's a multifaceted, but I mean, maybe I won't go into that, the details. I mean, that's one of the reasons I ultimately go for cosmopsychism in the penultimate chapter of my book. But I don't think it solves all the problems. I don't think it solves that conceivability problem ultimately. So I'm happy with, you know, there's something we're not getting here, and maybe it's just some feature of matter that we can't access. It's sort of, Colin McGinn had a famous paper that readers might be interested in 1989, Can We Solve the Mind-Body Problem? And he argues we just can't get it, the features of matter that underlie consciousness. I don't agree that he has a knockdown argument. You know, so Dirk Peraboom responses and think, well, why can't we, and Chalmers to an extent, theorize our way to the nature of these things. So I'm sort of cautiously pessimistic. I think we'll probably never get a completely transparent explanation of how human consciousness emerges from more fundamental forms of consciousness. But we can still keep trying, and you know, maybe I'm wrong. And the history of, you know, the track record of science doesn't, I don't think, give you any confidence that in this regard. But then the point is, so again, to repeat the point, okay, well, why not physicalism? But the point is, I think there are good arguments that physicalism is just incompatible with the essence of consciousness, which is not the case with panpsychism. So even if we can't, human limitations mean we can't fill in all the details, I still think we've got overwhelming reason to think it's the best guess at the nature of reality.
Final question comes from longtime listener Kelly Perez. Her question is, scientists can now reproduce artificial organs, but will they ever be able to reproduce artificial consciousness?
Oh, good question. What do you think, David?
Yes. I don't have a problem with that. So we've kind of touched on some of the issues here. Here's the way I think about it. Given my panpsychist inclination, I don't think there's any kind of huge problem about machines getting to be conscious. If we agonize about whether they're conscious or not, we might find that we can't quickly arrive at a satisfactory answer. But here's one thing I feel pretty sure about. If there was a machine that was quite person-like, could pass the Turing test, commanded Data in Star Trek, we wouldn't have any doubts that this was a being that was a proper object of moral concern. If this being could have plans, concerns, exhibit distress, argue, we'd treat it like a person. We'd regard it as an object of moral concern. I'm not sure how far off we are from this. Who knows how quickly artificial intelligence is going to move? It's not hard to imagine people interacting with computers, programs on computers, Siri, Alexa, and so on. I mean, they're just the same, in a way that will make them and most of us start to feel that we should worry about the welfare of these beings. I think that at that stage we wouldn't have any doubt that they were conscious. I think the decision about their being conscious in the way that requires moral concern will follow on the nature of the activities, not something that should be an input to the question of moral concern. I mean, it's effectively the point I was making about how to decide whether bees are suffering or not. The final point that I think really does bear thinking about is that you might worry about how it's going to be for these beings. There will be beings that I think we'll all count as conscious, that will be object of moral concern, which will be completely within our power. And the people who worry about the singularity think worrying about the converse possibility. But believe me, we control the switches in a way they don't. And we will be able to mistreat these beings. And it's something that people should maybe start worrying about quite soon.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was nicely represented. What was that recent HBO TV series
Westworld. Oh yeah. Yes, I know. They get to be conscious, and then they start cutting up nasty, don't they?
Yeah. We're pretty harsh with them.
Awful. Exactly.
I mean, I wrote some short about Westworld actually for the questions website, which is linked to on my blog somewhere. And I mean, I think it's again, you find in Westworld though, there's this sort of ambiguity about what consciousness is supposed to be that comes up again and again. Is consciousness it just experience the way we've been using it today, or is it self-awareness, the awareness of self, or is it some kind of radical free will? Mm-hmm. And I think in Westworld you're sort of flicking between the two and those, you know, the creatures are conscious when they start behaving in a way that goes against their programming, have some kind of radical free will. I was arguing with David Chalmers on email about this, actually. He thought that that's what they meant by consciousness in the show. I kind of think there's a little bit of ambiguity, and what they really meant was they were, you know, that's when they become conscious, when they get free will or something. Anyway, it's probably a little bit indeterminate. Yeah. Maybe David's wrong that the universe is causally closed, and maybe, you know... If that were wrong,
you didn't say that before.
So I'm slightly agnostic. I mean, I'm kind of happy to concede. I do sort of assume it in my work, but suppose it were true, then, you know, if there were these radically new causal processes that started emerging at some point of organic complexity, then that would be, you know, that would be a clear dividing line and a sign that, you know, all right, this is the mark of consciousness. But if that's false, let's assume it's false. Let's assume, you know, the physical world is causally closed. Then, you know, I agree with David. There's not going to be this clear dividing line. You know, we're going to certainly assume Commander Data is conscious. And so, I mean, come back to the question, I suppose. I mean, if you're a panpsychist, in a sense, it's very easy to create artificial consciousness because there's consciousness everywhere. But, I mean, I suppose the question is, well, how do we create, you know, can we create sophisticated kind of macro level rational consciousness, I suppose. And then I'd probably agree with David, and I think there mightn't be that much difference between, well, the physicalist and the panpsychist. It's going to depend on your theory of consciousness, you know, and your theory of what it takes for it to be consciousness, which is very much in part an empirical question. It's a theoretical question as well, and I think it's an open question, and, you know, it's not obvious that the panpsychist or the physicalist will have different answers to that. You know, if we have a scientific answer to what is physically required for consciousness, and, you know, maybe the panpsychist, the physicalist, and the dualist will all agree on that, but just give their different metaphysical accounts of what's going on. So, yeah, so I would probably just ditto what David said, assuming causal closure is true. I'm not entirely.
I just wanted to raise one final point. I'm not sure if this necessarily makes sense, but if we're claiming that, depending on how far off in the future is, that we can actually say map and create a conscious mind in a computer, then doesn't that raise the whole issue of, if we create a bunch of beings inside the computer, that therefore, because we've created that technology, that it's as likely that we could be in that same type of technology ourselves from another removed point? And if that is the case, then doesn't that kind of answer the question anyway? Because our consciousness is just a mapped version of something else that was mapped from something else. It could be like an infinite loop going through there. Because surely if we've created that technology, it's more likely than not that we are part of the same issue.
Yeah.
I don't follow that last bit of argument. Why is it if we created technology, it's likely that it's very, very unlikely that there should be beings who can create such technology. Look at the history of life on Earth. It's been going on for the best part of 4 billion years, and the kind of technology that we're talking about, it's been around for, I don't know, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years at most. I mean, beings that can develop that kind of technology are complete biological historical freaks. And so the chances of there being another one creating all of us is minimal. And anyway, wouldn't we have noticed the glitches like in the Matrix?
Well, no, because I guess the point would be is if we were able to completely replicate our own consciousness, that they would be capable of making the same thing in the future themselves. So, well, okay, perhaps not entirely like definitely likely. It's surely a possibility if we were able to replicate it.
But there's another question. If this is put, I think, did you put it in terms of computer simulations or...
Yeah.
I'm going to, whether a computer simulation would involve consciousness. It's not obvious to me that... I don't know. It depends on your theory of consciousness, and I think it's an open question. But I guess panpsychists to Russellian monists, who tend to think of consciousness as sort of a real categorical feature of the world and not going to think it's automatic, going to be skeptical of the idea that a computer simulation, a sort of virtual entity, would be conscious. So that might be one way around. If we've got good reason to think that virtual entities are not conscious, then that gives us a nice answer to an argument that we're not virtual entities, which I would like not to be, I think.
But what would be the biggest difference between an artificial mind that we put into a robot body and one that was in the computer? How is that fundamentally different?
So I don't think it's different. I'm curious, isn't there room for you to say that consciousness requires kind of biological wetware natures and silicon ones won't do the business? And I mean, is there room and are you attracted?
Well, I mean, I think panpsychism is open on this, and it's as open a question as it's for physicalism. So yeah, one thing is, can you have a silicon conscious thing? But then if you've just got a computer simulation, well, it depends how we're thinking of computer simulation. Maybe the hardware would be conscious, but the software is sort of, I guess a Russellian monist is going to be inclined to think that software isn't strictly speaking conscious because it's not a sort of metaphysically real entity. You might want further clarification on what I mean by metaphysically real.
That's nice. And you're right that... That physicalists and Rossinium are completely neutral on whether commander data is conscious. Both of us can require or not require that you need carbon-based chemistry rather than silicon-based chemistry or something to get consciousness. So that's open. I'm slightly interested in your idea that the hardware is going to be maybe conscious, but the virtual structure is not really in the business of being conscious because it doesn't have enough oomphy nature at the bottom because that makes me think about human brains and all the neurons, and then there's more abstract thing, the pain or the visual experience. Isn't that a bit like the virtual aspect of the machine?
It's a good point because it seems like it's natural to think if you're a Russellian monist that consciousness, human consciousness, corresponds in some way to information states in the brain. Because, I mean, it doesn't look like human consciousness doesn't look like the physical, the most natural way of carving up the physical stuff in the brain. It looks more like some the kind of informational properties. And informational properties seem a bit like software, a bit abstract, a bit sort of not fully... So, yes, the problem. I mean, my hope is going back to the structural mismatch problem that does... Well, these informational properties are real categorical features of the brain. They're just a really funny slice of the brain, from the third person perspective. But
have you been looking at recent stuff about proportional causation, kind of anti-Kim arguments in favor of the view that high-level properties can be causally efficacious in the fullest sense? So the generic property shared by all the beings who want to, say, hail a taxi, is the property that should be thought of as the cause of their waving their arm, and not the more specific neural property that differs between the different beings.
Proportional causation.
Proportional causation, that's Yablo, Menzies and List.
Yeah.
Causation is a high-level physical
PhD
phenomenon.
Student.
Exactly. I was just thinking that that's one resource you could appeal to back up the idea that these relatively generic high-level properties are really physically significant properties and thereby make some progress with the mismatch problem.
Thank you very much for joining us for this very special episode of the PanPsychCast. Thank you again to Philip Goff and David Papineau for sharing your philosophical insights with us and our audience today. If you'd like to hear more about Philip Goff and his new book Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, you can visit www.philipgoffphilosophy.com. And if you'd like to find out more about David Papineau and his new book Knowing the Score, you can visit www.davidpapineau.co.uk. Links to both websites are also on our website, thepanpsychcast.com. You can follow both philosophers on Twitter as well. Philip Goff's is Philip_Goff, and David Papineau's is @DavidPapineau.
You've been listening to the wonderful voices of Mr. Jack Symes.
Thank you for listening.
Gregory Miller.
Thank you for listening.
Associate Professor in Philosophy at Central European University in Budapest, Philip Goff.
Thank you very much. It's been lots of fun.
And Professor of Philosophy at King's College London, David Papineau.
Thank you all. I've enjoyed it a lot.
And me, Andrew Horton. Thank you very much for listening.
Superb.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks. That's very good.